Russia held its elections this weekend, and Vladimir Putin was unsurprisingly declared president. The Kremlin says it's a sign that Russians broadly approve of his war in Ukraine, which is now in its second year. Accurate polling on that is hard to come by, though. What we do know for sure is this. Both countries are suffering from a troop shortage, and Russia has a strategy to refill its ranks.
Yes, it is actually happening on a big scale, you know, not just from India and Nepal, but from countries like, you know, China, Kazakhstan, Uzbekistan, Tajikistan.
But last week, India said its citizens weren't voluntarily signing up for the Russian military. They were trafficked.
Several Indian nationals have been duped to work with the Russian army.
Coming up, Russia's accidental mercenaries and how they disguise the real cost of war.
Support for Jay Explained comes from FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. If you like spy thrillers or indeed Elizabeth Moss, then you might want to check out FX's The Veil. It's an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. Oh, I'll go. One woman has a secret, same here, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil, now streaming only on Hulu.
I think we can all agree the current political moment is fraught. But how does it compare to the other fraught political moments in history?
It felt for a time in part of that decade like everything was falling apart. Young people against old people, anti-war violence, peace movement.
I'm former U.S. Attorney Preet Bharara. And this week, presidential historian Doris Kearns Goodwin joins me on my podcast, Stay Tuned with Preet. We talk about difficult times in America's history and how its people overcame them. The episode is out now. Search and follow Stay Tuned with Preet wherever you get your podcasts.
It's Today Explained. I'm Halima Shah, filling in as guest host today. Since the beginning of the Russia-Ukraine war, reports have trickled in about men from thousands of miles away signing up to fight on the front lines in exchange for a paycheck. But last week, things came to a head in India, one of the countries where some of these men are recruited from.
The Indian government recently warned its citizens against job offers in the Russian army.
This is Shalu Yadav. She's an independent journalist in Delhi who worked on an investigation into the South Asian men fighting Russia's war.
India's investigative agency, known as the Central Bureau of Investigation, or the CBI, busted a network of agents and visa consultants who had been sending people to Russia on the pretext of giving them jobs.
You know, I think a lot of people might know that India and a lot of South Asian countries have a very large population of young men who go abroad to work, send money home, and will periodically come home.
Yes.
It sounds like that is something that the country is quite used to, but why was it so important for the Ministry of External Affairs to tell its citizens living over 2,000 miles away from Russia that you need to stay away from job offers from this country?
Well, you're absolutely right, Halima. There's a lot of foreign remittance that comes into the countries, in South Asian countries, by way of jobs that Indians get abroad, for instance, in Dubai. But why the government had to spring into action is because of the faraway war on the Russia-Ukraine border, because it had pulled dozens of Indians into its fold without them even realizing what they were getting into, which is a hardcore war. Travel agents who lure them arrange a tourist or a student visa for them, for which they charge a huge sum of about $4,000, Halima. So they're not breaking the law, because the Russian army has been inducting foreign manpower to increase its strength in the war against Ukraine. And it doesn't care if those coming in to join are on a tourist visa or on a student visa. Now, in one of the YouTube videos I watched by a travel agent, I heard him luring job seekers by telling them that a Russian passport will open the gateway to Europe, where they can go after 1 year of completing their contract with the Russian army. I spoke to a 31-year-old young man named Sarfaraz, who is from the city of Kolkata in India.
Basically, we're both normal family.
I am basically from a very normal family, ma'am.
In my family, there is my father, mother, two brothers, and my sister. My brothers and I work and support the family.
And he shared with me the details of how he was conned.
In August, my father started having pain in his foot, and the doctor said we might need to amputate it. And I got really scared. Whatever money I had, I spent on my father. I didn't have any work, and I was really stressed. My savings were almost done. And in the middle of all that, I got this video which said that there's work available. You'll get 3 months of training to be a security helper.
The way the travel agents put it in their videos to which they lured these men into these jobs, they described that this job is going to involve maybe, you know, job of a security guard, maybe manning the gates, you know, or sort of like cleaning the gun supplies when they come, or loading the trucks or unloading them, and so on.
I thought, once I get to Russia, I'll work and maybe my future will be better. That's why I went to Russia.
In fact, he asked his mother to spare all her savings and loaned money from his brother to pay the travel agent a fee of about $4,000. He was then clubbed with other men from different parts of the country who were flown to Moscow via Bahrain. And some of these men were flown via Dubai. In fact, these agents also duped Indians and Nepalis who were already working in Dubai into this job trap in Russia.
So it sounds like these agents are very aware of this large migrant worker community and are basically recruiting from various hotspots where people are in need of a paycheck and are willing to travel for one.
Exactly.
What does training for these men end up looking like?
So this training is almost like a crash course to be a soldier, Halima. These men are trained for 15 days to be a fighter. The training involves handling guns, grenades, and digging trenches. And after the training, they're taken in dozens to different parts of the front line where many have died over the last 6 months. Injured soldiers who return alive from the front line, some of them, they return with lost limbs and with grievous injuries. They are quickly replaced by the next batch of these trained soldiers.
What did your source, Sarfaraz, tell you about his experience in training? Did he go through it?
He told me that when he landed along with other men in Moscow, they were taken to a military facility where they were asked to sign contracts that were in Russian language, which they clearly didn't understand. The agents assured them that there's nothing to worry about and they should just go ahead and sign it. But to his shock, when he was sent to the military camp in Ryazan City in Russia, he discovered that the job of a helper actually does not exist. And he, along with other men from different countries, would be trained for 15 days to go ahead and fight the war on behalf of Russia.
Then they asked us, did you sign a contract? We said, yes. They said, the contract you signed, there's a group here called Wagner. You're now members of that. And for 1 year, you will go fight for us on the Ukraine border.
He actually didn't have words to describe his shock. He said that information just sent chills down his spine. And he immediately got in touch with another guy who was with him when he left from India. He was a part of the same group that was sent by the agent to Moscow. This guy's name was Hemel, and they had quickly become friends, you know, in the short period that they had spent together in India before they left for Moscow.
I met him for the first time, and he was so friendly. He was a really good guy.
Now, Hemel had been sent forward into the next camp where he was trained as a fighter. And Hemel got in touch with Sarfaraz and told him the reality of what had actually happened.
He said, if you come here, Sarfaraz, they will send you to the front. They're taking us 2,000 kilometers directly into Ukraine, to the front zone. I'm already here. And he said, I'm really scared, Sarfaraz. I can't do anything. But you can still get out because you're still in the city.
And how does Sarfaraz end up making his escape?
So Sarfaraz, you know, he spent first few couple of days after having realized that, you know, he's been scammed. He spent first few days in, you know, establishing friendships with the Russian commanders using Google Translate app. And in some time, he had sort of gained their confidence enough to be able to have permission to move out of the camp to buy some snacks or, you know, get some drinks for the group.
When I got out of the camp, I went straight to the Indian embassy in Moscow.
But to his surprise, the Indian embassies told him that, you know, it's going to take them a while to get him out using the official sort of diplomatic channels. As the Indian embassy was trying to figure out the details of how to get its citizen out of Russia, Sarfaraz decided that he's not going to go back to the Russian army. And so he decided to live in hiding in Moscow. And he described it as one of the toughest period of his life. It was about 3 weeks that he spent wherein he went hungry for days. And so he had a very tough time until he came across another Indian guy by the name of Raja Pathan, who had joined the Russian army a year ago, and he had managed to put in his papers. And so he helped him to get the money to apply for a white passport at the embassy, which in turn, got him a return visa to come back to India. And so he said that, you know, he wanted to return desperately to India to be able to help his best friend Hemil in that group.
Hemil, he used to say over and over again, Sarfaraz, my brother, please help me. Get us out of here. If it takes money, I'll get the money.
But when he came back to India, as soon as he landed, it was so sad that he got a call from one of the guys in Hemil's group who was sent to the front line that he had died in a drone strike.
It's too late for that.
Shalu, let's talk numbers. How many South Asians at this point have actually joined the Russian military? And do we have a sense of how many people are or are not making it back home?
Well, I can speak for Nepal and India because I've been in touch with Indian and Nepalese men who've been stuck in Russia over the last 3 months. Nepal's government puts the figure of Nepali men in Russia to 400. But the Nepali fighters I have interviewed over the last 3 months believe that the number is easily over 1,000. But as far as Indians are concerned, the government says 35 Indians were duped into joining the war. But that number, again, could be a lot higher, is what I've been told by my sources in Russia.
And of these potentially thousands of men, do we know how many are actually making it back home?
Not many, I'm afraid, Halima, unless you manage to escape the first army camp in Ryazan. Sarfaraz was lucky to escape the camp, but not all of them have had the luck to be able to do that. Now, obviously, the Indian government has woken up to the crisis over the last few days, and Nepal's government has been talking about it for months, but we haven't seen any news of Nepalese men returning home, actually. Families of those missing or who are in Russia pleading to come back have been asking questions of the government, but they haven't got any answers. In fact, recently, a group of Nepalese men shared a video with me where they are appealing to the Indian government to rescue them as their pleas to the Nepalese government have gone in vain. And they go on to say that because Indian government has a lot of clout abroad and its friendship with Russia is has been good historically. And so they are asking for Indian government to collectively sort of help them to get the Indians and Nepali men out of there.
Coming up on Today Explained, a defense expert tells us why men like Sarfaraz are part of a bigger trend and a global market for might.
Support for Jay Explained comes from FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. If you like spy thrillers or indeed Elizabeth Moss, then you might want to check out FX's The Veil. It's an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. Oh, I'll go. One woman has a secret, same here, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil, now streaming only on Hulu.
It's Today Explained. I'm Halima Shah, filling in as host today.
I started to track mercenaries about 20 years ago because I was one.
And this is Dr. Sean McFate, a professor at the National Defense University.
Or as we'd say in the industry, a private military contractor, which is a euphemism. I was originally in a U.S. Army paratrooper. I did that for about 8 years. I got out, and then I hopped to the dark side, as some would say, and I worked initially on U.S. government contracts in Africa, doing things traditionally given to the CIA or Special Operations Forces, and then I expanded. I was a free agent, if you will, working for oil companies and other things. Then I got out because I was not meeting older people in my industry.
Oh, wow. That was the reason.
Had to rethink some of my life choices. And also because I had seen some rather disturbing things about the privatization of warfare. And I wanted to think about the implications deeply.
Well, I'm glad we're talking to you, Sean, because we just spent the first half of our show talking about Nepali and Indian men who are going to Russia for what they think is a security job, only to find out once they get there that they're being sent to a 15 to 20 day training camp to allegedly become members of the Wagner Group. How would you classify these men? Are they technically mercenaries? Are they members of the dark side?
These men are victims of human trafficking in the market for might. And the world of mercenaries, think of it like a pyramid. At the very top, you call it Tier 1. They're like Special Operations Forces guys, like, you know, SEALs and Green Berets and Spetsnaz. And then lower, you have the Tier 2, which are pretty effective, offensive. Tier 3 is what most private military contractors are. They defend this oil line, defend this something. And then Tier 4 is sort of like not even mercenaries. They're more like conscripts into the mercenary world. They're either trafficked, like these Indian and Nepalese men were, tricked into it, or they were sort of dumped out of jail, which is what Prigozhin did. But these are purely cannon fodder. I mean, these are sort of unskilled fighters. And yeah, the world would view them as mercenaries, even though that they are being trafficked and victims. But it's in another world of mercenaries, if you can think of such a thing.
We've covered the Wagner Group in depth on this show, and we know that the Russian government is no stranger to working with hired guns. But I wonder if this particular strategy of, as you say, trafficking young, untrained fighters is something new.
It's not new to, you know, gang press people into mercenary outfits. That is as old as mercenary warfare, which is called the second oldest profession. What it shows you about Russia today is that they are desperate. They have chewed through the resources of the Wagner Group. Then they emptied out jails for the Wagner Group. They chewed through those resources. They have no more jails to empty out for this reason. And now they're starting to abduct, essentially, foreigners to fill the battlefield in Ukraine. So what it shows you is that Russia is run out of private military fighters, and they're doing schemes like in India and Nepal to put troops on the battlefield in Ukraine.
I'm wondering if you can talk about the real-life concerns that come up when we talk about an increasing reliance on mercenaries.
Russia has been turning to mercenaries because mercenaries are a way of disguising the costs of war to a population. Russians hate seeing Russian soldiers come home in body bags, but they don't care about dead contractors, whether they're Russian or they're Indian or whatever. So Putin likes to use mercenaries so he doesn't have big peace protests in the street of Moscow or St. Petersburg. So mercenaries disguise the costs of war, but they can also turn against you, as Putin himself learned last summer when the Wagner Group marched on Moscow. Right? And Putin sent attack helicopters and aircraft at them, and the Wagner Group shot them down. So when you create a world of mercenaries, you always have problems of control, safety, and accountability. And that also a world awash in mercenaries. Mercenaries, we know from history, are incentivized to start wars and elongate wars for profit. So a world with more mercenaries in it is a world with more warfare and human suffering.
We're talking about Putin and Russia specifically, and the ability to disguise the cost of war when you are relying on contractors, especially foreign contractors, because nobody wants to see one of their citizen soldiers come back in a body bag. That sounds like something that would be a reality everywhere. So are we seeing other countries play the same game that Putin is?
Yes. The United States of America played this game during the wars of Iraq and Afghanistan. Initially, like Putin, they thought those wars would be very quick, a few days, a few weeks. And when they protracted, they couldn't get enough Americans to volunteer for the U.S. armed forces. And so they turned to contractors increasingly over the years. And a lot of those contractors came from other countries. So when I was in this industry, I worked alongside people from every single continent except for Antarctica, including South Asia. Hmm. When those contracts ended, a lot of them went home and they started their own mercenary companies or looked for more work. And we've seen them appear in places like Africa and the Middle East. We've seen the UAE and the Gulf states hire them to prosecute the war in Yemen. We've seen them on both sides of the war in Libya. We've seen them throughout sub-Saharan Africa. You know, you see them in conflict markets. So any place where there is things like natural resources to extract or war to fight, and you have wealthy clients and unconstrained political rivalries, very weak rule of law, you will see mercenaries start to gather there. But we're seeing every year an increase of mercenaries globally.
Wow.
And this is the problem, because if this trend continues into the next decade or two, we could have wars without states. You know, one oil company fighting another oil company's rented force. You know, billionaires are like Elon Musk having his own space force. I mean, what does it mean when states no longer have the monopoly of force?
Sean, you're painting a very complicated picture here. At times, it sounds like a world with more mercenaries is doomed for longer, more violent wars. And then at others, it sounds like a world with more mercenaries is just a return to a world order that existed maybe long before the citizen army did. But at the end of the day, I think everyone's concern is kind of the same, that how do we make war less violent and less frequent? And I want to put that question to you. How do we make war less violent and less frequent in light of these trends?
Well, it's a great question. And I would say this, is that mercenaries, they are like fire. They can either burn your house down, but if you use them well, they can power a steam engine. We could also use mercenaries to stop genocides, to stop, you know, terrorist groups, and to stop, you know, brutal invasions like Russia invading Ukraine. And most mercenaries I talk to, except for the psychopaths, would rather work on the side of angels than devils. The second is that we can't forget that, yes, we are returning to a world order that's a lot more ancient and now forgotten, a world before citizen armies where, you know, force was something you could rent from a marketplace and everybody did it and was fairly normalized. So we're going to see a world, I think, of world order that where not where nation states don't rule everything, others can rule too. And some may be good and some may be bad, but it's going to be a lot more sticky world. The world's not going to implode, but this idea that states can responsibly govern the world as a whole also, I think that myth needs to be challenged a bit as well.
Sean McFate, writer, veteran, ex-mercenary. Today's episode was produced by Hadi Mawagdi, edited by Matt Collette, fact-checked by Laura Bullard, engineered by Rob Byers, and guest-hosted by me, Halima Shah. It's Today Explained.